Well, the topic for our study tonight is George Mueller, Believer's Chapel, and the Life of Faith. And I'm going to read Psalm 23, verse 1 through verse 6, for two reasons. One, because it has special reference to George Mueller and the ministry carried on in Bristol, but it also was one of the last passages that he himself expounded in a public meeting in the church in Bristol. So we'll just read verse 1 through verse 6, or Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. I think that's such a fitting passage for Mr. Mueller to expound in the last year of his life. He had, in the last year or so, he had stopped preaching on Sunday evenings and went out of his custom to expound Psalm 23 in the last year of his life in the evening service. George Mueller, Believer's Chapel, and the Life by Faith. Mueller's life is perhaps the greatest example of the life of faith in modern times. It's remarkable when we think of the way in which Bristol, England, responded to the death of George Mueller. The whole city, in effect, had something of a holiday. Many, many people were there for his funeral. In fact, Bethesda Chapel was so filled, no one could get in, and on the outside also. And then around the church, there was a large crowd, and finally, in the cemetery where Mr. Mueller was buried, there were 7,000 people who were there for the funeral of this man. It's remarkable to read some of the testimonies to him in the ordinary newspapers of the British Isles, the London Times, Manchester papers, Bristol papers, other papers also gave special coverage for the life and ministry of George Mueller. As you probably know, at the conclusion of Mueller's life, there were over 2,000 orphans that were in the Bristol orphanages, and there were also 200 workers who were workers in the orphanage, and all of them were supplied by the funds that were literally prayed down by Mueller and others for that work in Bristol. Never was an appeal for funds ever made. And always Mr. Mueller went to the Lord, and the result was a magnificent testimony to trust in God. In fact, in one way, we could say that Mueller was a kind of a New Testament times Abraham or an Elijah, with the doctrine of the Apostle Paul, because he lived in New Testament times, of course. For his lifetime, and you must remember that pounds in the 19th century were much more valuable than the pounds today, just as the dollars of the last century are so much more than the dollars of today. But in the 19th century, 1.5 million pounds was given for the orphanages, and 500,000 pounds for the Scriptural Knowledge Institute. Now, the Scriptural Knowledge Institute is not known so well, of course, as the orphanages, but you can see It was a large work and had a number of different outreaches in the ministry of the Word of God, with Bibles, with missionary endeavor. The Scripture Knowledge Institute was probably the primary supporter of the China Inland Mission for a number of its earlier years. And so what Mr. Mueller did was not simply a work in Bristol, but a work that literally reached over the world. They were supporting, I believe at one time, 130 missionaries of the China Inland Mission. And most of the people in the earlier work of the mission were supported through the work in Bristol by Mr. Mueller. That's one of the reasons, of course, that the China Inland Mission never made any appeal for funds. They operated on the same basis that Mueller did. And I remember when I first became a Christian and became acquainted with the China Inland Mission, which now I think is known as the Overseas Mission, the China Inland Mission was the mission that everyone knew as the largest of the faith missions, and also the one that made no appeals whatsoever for funds. Those seem like ancient times with the way the Christian church has come since then. Well, what I'd like to do is to say a few words about the life of George Mueller and then say some things about Believer's Chapel in the light of it, and finally a few words about the life of faith. But we'll devote most of the time to George Mueller. Mr. Mueller was a German. Mr. Mueller was born in Prussia, in East Prussia, in a place called Kroppenstedt. And he was born in 1805. He died in 1898, so he lived to be 92 years of age, and was preaching in his 92nd year also on Psalm 23, verse 1 through verse 6. He was, in his earlier years, just what you might expect. He was the son of a father who had a fairly responsible position, but right in the beginning of his life, he was caught stealing by his father from the funds of his father. He also was in prison at 16 years of age because he had borrowed funds and did not pay them back, and finally found himself in prison, and his father got him out of the prison. He then studied at the gymnasium, as all fairly well-to-do Germans do, and graduated from the gymnasium in 1822 with debts and some other things. He also did a few things that were rather strange. But at the conclusion of his training in the gymnasium, which is the equivalent, as probably most of you know, to the first year of university, that meant that he had three more years of university. So he went to the University of Halle, and there he went through the university. He had money problems again. He made a trip down to Switzerland, and he got a number of his friends together to share the trip with him, but he was handling the money. So the result was that they largely paid for his trip. He was able to do that. Obviously, he was a very clever individual. But after the trip to Switzerland, he came into contact with a man who had enough of an influence upon him to get him interested in spiritual things, and he was converted. And in his conversion, there was, of course, a tremendous change in him. He became acquainted with August Tallach, who was one of the great evangelical university professors in theology. As a matter of fact, Charles Hodge, who was for many years professor of theology at Princeton Seminary, and perhaps one of the leading, or one or two or three leading theologians of the United States in the 19th century, studied with Professor Tallach there in Halle. He came into contact with him and Professor Tallack had an influence upon him. And after his conversion, he finally became a missionary to the Jews in the city of London. He was at one time thinking about going to Austria to do work there, but it finally turned out that he came to London. Well, after he had been there, he became disenchanted with the work in London. He incidentally was an excellent student of language. He was an excellent student of Hebrew and Greek. He knew about six or seven languages, I've forgotten the precise number, but he was able to preach in French and in German, and I believe also in Spanish as well as English, though of course his native language was German. After he came to London, he became ill at one point in his life there, and it was in the early years of his ministry. He decided as a result of his health that he should go somewhere and rest. He did this, incidentally, a couple of times in his earlier years of his life. At one point, his health was not real strong. But while he was in a little place called Teignmouth in southern England, the thought developed that he perhaps should give himself to a different kind of ministry. And so he began to think about such things as the supreme authority of the scriptures. He had been taught in a kind of background which was not absolutely clear and plain. But while he was thinking over these things, he came to believe that the proper attitude towards scripture was to take it as the supreme authority of God through the Holy Spirit, and therefore he would rest upon what scripture said. He also became very much interested in the doctrine of divine election. And in the course of the study of the doctrine of divine election, he came to understand the grace of God in election in a very, very clear way. In fact, he came to believe in unconditional election. He also had been a post-millennialist as a result of his training previously, but through his study, through this time in Teignmouth, he became a premillennialist. It was kind of like a second conversion. So one of the authors of or biographers of Mueller's life has said, he came to understand that Israel had a future. He believed in the future of Israel, but he did not accept what we know as the pre-tribulational rapture of the church. He rather accepted the post-tribulational rapture of the church, but he believed very strongly in a soon return of our Lord. So that became his theology. While he was out there, he was asked if he would serve as the pastor of Ebenezer Chapel, and in 1830, he began to do pastoral work in Ebenezer Chapel in Teignmouth in southern England. But he was studying the scriptures, and finally, as a result of meditating, when I say finally, this all happened very relatively soon. He was still a young man. But from the reading of scriptures such as Acts chapter 20 and verse 7, and upon the first day of the week when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul preached unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. Mr. Mueller came to believe that the Lord's Supper should be observed every Sunday, and in Ebenezer Chapel they began to observe the Lord's Supper every Sunday, feeling that that was the scriptural way that the Lord's Supper should be observed. Furthermore, he began to study other things that had to do with Christian ministry, and he came to the conviction that he should not take a salary from the church. And so I'm old enough, I can remember a number of churches in the United States that back in the 30s and 40s had no offering taken in their churches. For example, it's my understanding, Kent Steinbeck, I think, was here, but it's my understanding, for example, that the Greenville Presbyterian Church for a long time operated with simply a box at the back And other churches around you probably know, because that was right popular in evangelical churches. And I can remember in Schofield Memorial Church when that was true there too. When they were downtown on Harwood, they didn't take up an offering. They had boxes in the back. That's about 45 years ago. But that was very common. And so he felt that he should not take up a salary. And so they put boxes at the back, and that's the way he and others were paid for their ministry. He had some very, very definite changes in his opinions. He said that he thought that there should be no more going to man instead of going to the Lord. And so he began to carry on his ministry in that way, looking only to the Lord, and all they had was a little box in the back of the church. There are some interesting illustrations that characterized Mr. Mueller's experience, and I'd like to read a few of them tonight, here and there, because they're very interesting and illustrate the kind of training that Mueller received from the Lord as he prepared for, as God was preparing him for the great work that God was going to do through him. On page 45 of this book called George Mueller, Delighted in God by Roger Steer, these are the words that Mr. Steer writes. Mueller also decided that from that time onwards he would ask no one, not even his fellow Christians in Ebenezer Chapel, to help him financially in any way. There would be no more, quote, going to man instead of going to the Lord, unquote. Mueller admitted that this decision required more grace than to give up my salary, but it was this decision, probably more than anything else, that makes the story of his life from this time so exciting. At this time also, they decided to take, he and his wife, Luke 12:33, sell that ye have and give alms, literally, and carry out the commandment. And during the rest of his life and the rest of her life, because she died long before him, they carried out that particular method of receiving help in the ministry of the word. So he thought of the Lord as one who was well able to answer his prayers. On another page shortly after this, there's an interesting little account in which this is kind of illustrated. The money in the home had been reduced to 10 shillings. 10 shillings, well, a farm laborer earned about 10 shillings a week. But they had been reduced to about 8 shillings. And so that morning they'd asked God to give them some more money. They had a visit from a lady member of the church who lived in a village, and during the conversation the hostess asked Mueller, "Do you have any money?" "I told the brethren, dear sister, when I gave up my salary that I would for the future tell the Lord only about my wants." She replied, "But he has told me to give you some money. About a fortnight ago I asked him what I should do for him, and he told me to give you some money. And last Saturday it came again powerfully to my mind and has not left me since, and I felt it so forcibly last night that I could not help speaking of it to brother," the name is not given, it's brother P. Mueller rejoiced when he realized how God had answered their prayers, but still thinking better not to mention their circumstances, he changed the subject to other matters, and when they left, the lady gave him 2 guineas. The following week at Exmouth, when they were reduced to about 9 shillings, Mueller prayed again for money, and within 30 hours, they were given £7.10 from 3 different sources. Mueller commented on the first few weeks after their decision to ask God alone for funds, "Admire the gentleness of the Lord that he did not try our faith much at the commencement, but gave us first encouragement and allowed us to see his willingness to help us before he was pleased to try it more fully." In the chapel, they put a box up at the back, and it was intended originally that the box would be emptied once a week and the funds given to Mr. Mueller and his wife, but as was sometimes the case, those things were forgotten, and consequently in one In some cases, the box would be back there for 3 weeks and even as much as 5 weeks. And in the meantime, Mr. Mueller and his wife had no funds. So there's one instance in the book in which the account is given. On Saturday, June the 11th, 1831, Mueller and Henry Craik returned from Torquay, where they had been preaching. Craik recorded in his diary how powerfully Mueller had preached on the Friday. The Muellers had 9 pence left. And so Mueller prayed that the Lord would be pleased to impress it on Brother Wyatt that we wanted money so that he might open the box. Next morning at breakfast, the Muellers had just enough butter for a friend and a relative who were staying with them. They made no mention of their circumstances, of course, so that their visitors should not feel uncomfortable. After the morning meeting, Brother Y quite unexpectedly opened the box and gave Mueller the contents, 1 pound, 8 shillings, 10 and a half pence. That is the equivalent of rather more than 2 weeks' wages. Poor Brother Y, who had evidently learnt his lesson the hard way, told George that he and his wife had been unable to sleep the previous night for worry that the Muellers might be in need. And Roger Steer says Mueller found it hard to conceal a smile. I think perhaps he was enjoying the fact that he had a sleepless night because he hadn't been opening the box as he should. Well, there was another man by the name of Craik who was out in the general area, Henry Craik. He was a Scot, actually, and he and Mueller had a lot of fellowship together. And at Bethesda Chapel in Bristol, the two began to work together. They were called there. A. Arthur T. Pearson, who also wrote a book on George Mueller, one of the best, said that that church, Bethesda Chapel, in the place in Bristol, was one of the two truly apostolic churches that I know. Well, as a result of the ministry in Bristol and the things that were happening, Mr. Mueller began to have ideas about further ministry beside the preaching ministry. And so he and Craik and others became concerned about other ways to reach people. And Mueller particularly took the lead, and in 1834 there was founded the Scriptural Knowledge Institute for Home and Abroad. And the purpose of the Scriptural Knowledge Institute was to have day schools, Sunday schools, and adult Bible schools. And then also to have Bibles, to distribute Bibles, and then to do mission work. And even, I think, 10 years ago, that institution was still in existence, and $150,000 or $200,000 is being given every year still to those things. The results of that work were remarkable, and most people do not realize that this was also part of Mr. Mueller's work. I think that this may give you some idea of some of the things that were being done. During the previous months, SKI, that's the institute, had financed, besides 100 children in the homes, a whole number of other important activities, including 2 Sunday schools, 2 adult schools, one for men and one for women, which on 4 evenings in the week, nearly 350 people were taught reading and writing, their books and writing materials being supplied free of charge. The opportunity was, of course, taken to point out the way of salvation at some classes. 6 day schools, 3 boys, 3 for boys, 3 for girls. Mueller's aim was that the poorest citizens of Bristol should be able to send their children to school entirely free or on payment of 1/5 or 1/6 of the expenses. They were also intended to enable Christian parents of modest means to send their children to school where the teachers were all believers. From March 1834 to May 1842, well over 2,500 children were taught at these schools. All these adult and children's schools were entirely financed by Mueller's institution. So you can see that there were a lot of things that were going on besides what is known as the orphanage work. In addition, Roger Steele says, from its foundation in 1834, SKI had circulated nearly 7,000 Bibles. In the 17 months ending May 1842, nearly 130 pounds had been sent to missionaries in Jamaica, Australia, Canada, and the East Indies. In the same period, well over 22,000 short Christian books or pamphlets had been distributed, the greater part free of charge. So the work that was being carried on was not simply the work in the church, but also throughout the city. The Bristol orphan houses are the houses and is the work by which Mueller was particularly known and known to our day. And I think it might be good to read some of the things that Mr. Steer points out about it. The motives for the work suggested, I think, by this particular paragraph. He had decided to embark upon this adventure, and mind you now, Mr. Mueller at this time is not an old man. I've forgotten the exact date of the orphanages, but he was in his 30s. He decided to embark upon the adventure, far more daring, far more exciting even than the construction by Brunel of his mighty bridge at Clifton. He put the challenge that faced him like this. Now, if I, a poor man, simply by prayer and faith, obtained without asking any individual, and that was, as Mueller wrote that, he put that in italics, without asking any individual the means for establishing and carrying on an orphan house, there would be something which, with the Lord's blessing, might be instrumental in strengthening the faith of the children of God, besides being a testimony to the consciences of the unconverted of the reality of the things of God. And he went on to say with reference to this, I certainly did from my heart desire to be used by God to benefit the bodies of poor children, bereaved of both parents, and seek in other respects with the help of God to do them good for this life. I also particularly longed to be used by God in getting the dear orphans trained up in the fear of God. But still, the first and primary object of the work was that God might be magnified by the fact that the orphans under my care are provided with all they need only by prayer and faith, without anyone being asked by me or my fellow laborers, whereby it may be seen that God is faithful still and hears prayers still. About that time, I was 1835, he was 30 years of age, he was struck by the words of Psalm 81, verse 10, open thy mouth wide, and I will fill it. There are some very interesting little stories that are found in this book of the experiences of Mr. Mueller. One of them is recorded in this book on page 71. This is connection with 100 pounds. When 100 pounds, which is a tremendously large gift at the time, was given to Mr. Mueller, and when he discovered who it was that had given it, he knew this woman was a woman who earned about 3 shillings 6 pence a week. Think of that now. 3 shillings 6 pence a week. Now, of course, today that wouldn't be worth a dollar, but in those days it was worth a little more. That's what she made for 1 week, but she gave 100 pounds. So when he discovered who had sent the 100 pounds, he was reluctant to accept it. He knew she was a woman who earned about 3-6 a week by needlework and decided to visit her to find out whether the money had been given in a moment without thought of the cost. He discovered that the woman had been left 480 pounds on the death of her father. On receipt of the money, she had parted with a large sum to pay off some outstanding family debts and had given her mother 100 pounds. She had then sent the 100 toward the orphan house. Mueller spoke to her at great length, hoping to persuade her to reconsider. Her reply was brief. The Lord Jesus has given his last drop of blood for me, and should I not give all the money I have? Rather than the orphan house should not be established, I will give all the money I have. He left the house not only with 100 pounds, but another 5 pounds for the poorer members of Gideon and Bethesda. These were two churches which she insisted that he should take. Mueller commented, during life, her lifetime, I suppose not six brethren and sisters among us knew that she had ever possessed 480 pounds, so that she had given 100 toward the orphan house. It's a remarkable story, you know, they just over and over again, and all the time Mueller is keeping all of this to himself. No one knew anything about what was transpiring there except from observing it from the outside. But he had a period of trial from 1838 to 1846. Some of the greatest trials occurred. Later on, when the work became so well known and when Mueller became so well known, they had an excess of money. And people were happy to give them money, and they were sending money all over the world then. But in the early days, that was something else. And to read the experiences is really a remarkable thing, because over and over again, they would face the next day with nothing. And then in miraculous ways, for they were miraculous from our standpoint, God would supply their needs. One of these is rather interesting. Well, they're all interesting, but one of them was interesting to me. This is within that period of time, and they had just come about to the end of their monies, and we read from Steer's book, that afternoon a lady and gentleman visited the homes in Wilson Street. At the boys' house, they met two ladies who were also on a visit, one of whom turned to the matron and said, of course you cannot carry on these institutions without a good stock of funds. And turning to the matron, the gentleman then said, have you a good stock? Well, I see they had the principle was they were not to tell anybody about anything. So the matron said, our funds are deposited in a bank which cannot break. Cleverly avoiding breaking the rule never to reveal the state of the funds. Tears came into the eyes of the inquiring lady. On leaving, the gentleman left 5 pounds at the boy's home. But over and over again, one after another, of these instances are taking place that just really are astonishing. How would you do, people sometimes said to Mueller, in case there were a meal time to come and you had no provisions for the children, or they really wanted clothes and you had no money to procure them? Such a thing is impossible, Mueller would assure them. As long as the Lord gives us grace to trust in him, for whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed. So that's an impossible thing you're suggesting. That would never happen. Now, I might say there are a number of illustrations in Mueller's experience in which that was true the night before. But even before breakfast, someone would arrive with loaves and for other food for them to eat, so that they never did have insufficiency on the table. They didn't have anything left, but it was constantly like that. On another page here, I marked out a couple of the passages that impressed me very much. One of the nearest approaches to such a, he says, but so long as we shall be enabled to trust in the living God, and so long as, though falling short in every way of what we might be and ought to be, we are at least kept from living in sin, such a state of things, that is, when they would have insufficiency, could not occur. Or cannot occur. One of the nearest approaches to such a situation occurred in February of 1842. At midday on Tuesday, the 8th, there was enough food in all the houses for that day's meals, but no money to buy the usual stock of bread for future use, or milk for the following morning. Two houses, by this time they had about 5 orphan houses, and ultimately they had over 2,000 orphans, but I don't know that he tells us what the number was at this particular point. Probably within 100 or so. But, and it goes on to say, usual stock of bread for future use of milk for the following morning. Two houses needed coal. In Mueller's view, they had never been in greater poverty, and he noted that if God sent nothing before 9 next day, his name would be dishonored. Mueller says, late in the afternoon, 9 plum cakes arrived, baked by order of a kindly sister. Encouraging and no doubt tasty as they were, the situation was still grim as Mueller retired to bed that night. He finished that day's journal entry with the words, incidentally, he kept the finest kinds of records through all of this. As his Germanic nature came out, and all of the records are there that he wrote day after day after day. He says, finished the day's journal entry with the words, truly, we are poorer than ever, but through grace, my eyes look not at the empty stores and the empty purse, but to the riches of the Lord only. Next morning, Mueller walked early to Wilson Street to discover how God would meet the need, only to find on arrival between 7 and 8 that it had already been met. A Christian businessman had walked about half a mile to his place of work when the thought occurred to him that Mueller's children might be in need. He decided, however, not to retrace his steps then, but to take something to the homes that evening. But as he later told Mueller, I couldn't go any further and felt constrained to go back. He delivered 3 sovereigns to the boy's home. This donation, together with some other smaller sums, met the needs for 2 days. So this is going on day after day, year after year. That, I would think, would try your faith. Well, ultimately, in 1861, there were 2,000 children, and they had moved to a new location, had built, I think, 5 big buildings, no mortgages on them. They were paid for. And the 2,000 children were being cared for by the ministry in Bristol. Mr. Mueller, after the conclusion of that period of time, engaged in a worldwide preaching ministry. His first wife died in around 1870, and he married again about 2 years later, a little less than 2 years, and he began a worldwide preaching ministry because the orphanages had been built up in such a way, and they were so widely known that they had very little problems with money. The only thing that really was a problem was expansion and obtaining new property and places to build and money to build new buildings. And so he began to engage in a worldwide preaching ministry, and the rest of his life, about 17 years, he traveled 200,000 miles over the face of the globe, really. He preached and taught in 30 different countries in the 17 years. And was in the United States, taught and preached in many of the places in the United States. The highlight of the place that he preached, I'm sure, was he preached in Charleston, South Carolina. That was the highlight of the whole time, I imagine. But that was one of the ways in which God honored this great man of faith. He died in 1898 at age 92, March the 10th. He had gone upstairs and was found the next morning lying upon the floor. He had a sudden heart attack, evidently, although the book doesn't really say why. I assume that was it. And the Bethesda crowd, where the church was, the Bethesda church had just this tremendous crowd, 100 different carriages were in the funeral procession. The mayor's state coach was one of them, 7,000 people at the cemetery, and the obituaries were just remarkable testimonies to the faith of this man and others who served with him. The assets of Mr. Mueller at the time of his death were one, and this includes his furniture, 160 pounds. In other words, perhaps by our money, maybe $1,500 or $2,000, that's all that he had. He never believed in going out of his way to lay up any funds, and I want to say something about that in a moment. But this is a remarkable testimony. Now, I'd like to say a few things about Believer's Chapel. because that was the title of the subject for tonight, George Mueller, Believer's Chapel. The principles of Believer's Chapel are not entirely the principles of George Mueller, but very close to Mr. Mueller's principles. And I confess in my own life, they have been very instrumental in my own thoughts about the way in which the Lord's work should be supported. When I was in Birmingham, Alabama, in the insurance business, I read Arthur T. Pearson's book, George Mueller of Bristol. And Mr. Pearson was an outstanding Presbyterian minister and preacher, one of the great ones of the latter part of the 19th century. Preached in Spurgeon's tabernacle for a lengthy period of time, and Spurgeon even wanted him to succeed him there because he was such a great preacher. But I read through George Mueller of Bristol, written by Mr. Pearson, and I came to understand something of the principles by which Mueller operated and by which it appeared to me that the scriptures set forth that we should operate. The principles that Mueller used were simply they would look to the Lord for their funds, and they would not look to anyone else. They would not advertise their needs except to the Lord. And so just as these individuals were told never to divulge their need except to the Lord in prayer, they never divulged their needs. So he operated in that way. The finances of that great work were truly by faith. And individuals other than Mr. Mueller and those that he took into his counsel at the institutions themselves had no idea of the need or even from whence came the money. Howard Pryor called me today and he said, Jews for Jesus have been after the elders to have a meeting in Believer's Chapel, but there is a bit of a problem. The Jews for Jesus want to take up an offering in Believer's Chapel, and the elders of Believer's Chapel would be happy to have the Jews for Jesus present their ministry, but they would be unhappy and would not permit an offering to be taken in Believer's Chapel. So they've been at loggerheads, and every year the Jews for Jesus call him, so he said, and every year he has to say no to them. So I can see from just what were Mr. Mueller's principles, he wouldn't have allowed him either to have a meeting in the orphanage because they would want to take up an offering, and he was opposed to that particular type of thing. The principles of the chapel have been that we would look to the Lord for our funds, and that's why we do not, among other things, have offerings. We do not even have the back. We don't have a box. I would not necessarily be opposed to that kind of thing, because at the evening, when the believers are there, we do take an offering. But when the unbelievers are here, we don't pass the plates for them by way of conviction. The chapel has stood also for gifted ministry, that is, ministry by gifted individuals. Mueller himself held to that particular principle. He met with those that were known as the Christian Brethren. And at Bethesda and the other places where he preached, that was what they practiced. And he had come to the conviction from the study of the Bible that that was the way that ministry should be carried on. Ministry by gifted individuals. As far as meetings and the Lord's Supper is concerned, Mr. Mueller had the same principles that we have here. There were ministry meetings, and at the same time, the Lord's Supper meeting, the Lord's Supper being observed every Sunday in the churches in which Mr. Mueller served. Oversight was by a body of elders. And oversight is not by an ordained man who has a special status, such as is characteristic of our churches today, but ministry is by gifted men and oversight by a body of elders. There is in Believer's Chapel, just as in Bethesda and other of the chapels that Mr. Mueller was identified with later. There was the centrality of the scriptures, there was the headship of Jesus Christ was acknowledged. So in Believer's Chapel, these are the principles that we have sought to carry out. I think this has some special relevance for us as we think about an addition to our building, because the elders are, as I understand them, are very convinced that we should look simply to the Lord, and there should be no appeals for funds as are ordinarily made. We would look to the Lord. And consequently, as I understand them, and they are free to correct my understanding, as I understand them, they will, when it's necessary to consider the matter most seriously, they will look to the Lord for the funds and will construct the building in that way so that no appeals are made to any individual or any body of people. It's rather interesting that when the letter went out not long ago, that some people have told the elders that they would like them to know right now that they're not going to give. They regarded that letter in which there was no appeal for funds as if it were an appeal for funds, because of the background that so many people have in churches that practice that kind of methodology. But we intend to look to the Lord. And if the Lord supplies the funds, then the building or the addition to the building will be built. If the Lord does not supply the funds, it will not be built. And incidentally, Mr. Mueller at one point did borrow some money. It was in connection with building a building. And he had considerable, what do you call it? You borrow money against... Yeah, collateral. He had sufficient collateral. He had land, and it was far more than the loan. I've forgotten the amount of the loan. It was not real big. And for a short time, he borrowed money from the bank and gave that property in as collateral. As far as I know, that was the only time that that ever happened. He said that, and he was in harmony with that. It was not something that he did that he felt bad about. So this is in essence the way he carried on his ministry. Incidentally, that ministry, so far as I know, is still going on today, although the character of it has changed somewhat. But it's my understanding that they still do not appeal for funds. It's a very close connection with the China Inland Mission through the years. And Mr. Mueller, in the earlier years, Mr. Mueller and the work in Bristol supported well over 100 of the missionaries of the China Inland Mission as well. Well, I'd like to, for a few moments, in closing with a couple of illustrations, turn back to Psalm 23. Incidentally, a West Country farmer once said of Mueller, this is West Country of Britain, the 23rd Psalm seemed written on his face. That was the way he put it. As far as the Bible was concerned, Mr. Mueller claimed to have read the Bible. Incidentally, he claimed to have read it, and I'm quoting him, considerably more than 100 times. But not only did he read it, but he said he read it with prayer and meditation. In other words, it was not like the Bible Memory Association trying to read it to win a prize, but he read it with prayer and meditation over 100 times, considerably more, as he put it, than 100 times. Prayer was, of course, the other means by which his work succeeded, humanly speaking. There are people who have often given suggestions about why Mr. Mueller was so successful. They've suggested that he was a foreigner, and he still had a little bit of a German accent. And we all like to give to people who have a little bit of German accent, don't we? Well, I see that you don't like that necessarily. Well, that was one of the reasons they said he got his money. He had an accent. Another reason they suggested was the novelty of the way. That is, the idea of looking to the Lord to supply your needs. That was such a novel way. that people gave because of the novelty. Well, I'll tell you one thing is when it comes to taking money out of your pocketbook and putting it on a plate, the novelty wears off rather quickly if it's only novelty. You can be sure of that. And the other thing, well, the other suggestion was that he had a secret treasure. And after all, he was from Germany, he was a university graduate, he was came from a fairly well-to-do family, and so he's got some secret treasure from which he draws his funds and enables him to do the work. There are so many interesting illustrations in this, it would take us all night to detail them. Incidentally, this is an excellent little book. It's been a long time since I read Mr. Pearson's book, but this one is George Mueller, Delighted in God by Roger Steer. And any Texan ought to be able to read that with pleasure, Roger Steer. And I found it very interesting, and it's filled with illustrations, and is, I think, a very good book. But I'll just have time to read maybe one or two little things that are stated in it. The boiler of the central heating unit in 1857 was having some problems, and so they had to do work because it was December. And so the weather was rather bad. The day was fixed. The workmen were to come. All the necessary arrangements were made. The fire, of course, had to be let out while the repairs were going on. But now see, after the day was fixed for the repairs, a bleak north wind set in, began to blow either on Thursday or Friday before the Wednesday afternoon when the fire was to be let out. Now came the first really cold weather which we had in the beginning of that winter during the first days of December. What was to be done? The repairs couldn't be put off. I now asked the Lord, Mr. Mueller said, for two things, that he would be pleased to change the north wind into the south wind, and that he would give to the workmen a mind to work. For I remembered how much Nehemiah accomplished in 52 days whilst building the walls of Jerusalem because the people had a mind to work. Well, the memorable day came, the evening before the bleak north wind blew still, but on the Wednesday the south wind blew exactly as I had prayed. The weather was so mild that no fire was needed. The brickwork was removed. The leak was found out very soon. The boiler makers began to repair in good earnest. About 8:30 in the evening, when I was going home, I was informed at the lodge that the acting principal of the firm whence the boilermakers came had arrived to see how the work was going on and whether he could in any way speed the matter. I went immediately, therefore, into the cellar to see him with the men to seek to expedite the business. In speaking to the principal of this, he said in their hearing, "The men will work late this evening and come very early again tomorrow." "We would rather, sir," said the leader, "work all night." Then I remembered the second part of my prayer, that God would give the men a mind to work. Thus it was. By the morning, the repair was accomplished. The leak was stopped, though with great difficulty, and within about 30 hours, the brickwork was up again, and the fire and the boiler, and all the time the south wind blew so mildly that there was not the least need of a fire. This book is full of interesting stories, and they're only some of the stories, but one of them, I just have to mention this one, too. I think I've used this in a message some time back, but Mr. Steer does give it here. Mr. Mueller, in 1877, was coming to the United States, and he had an engagement. And off Newfoundland, the weather turned cold, and the ship's progress was seriously retarded by fog. The captain had been on the bridge for 24 hours, and something happened which was to revolutionize his life. George Mueller appeared on the bridge. "Captain, I've come to tell you I must be in Quebec by Saturday afternoon." "It's impossible," said the captain. "Very well," said Mueller. "If your ship cannot take me, God will find some other way. I've never broken an engagement for 52 years. Let's go down into the chart room and pray." The captain wondered what lunatic asylum Mueller had come from. "Mr. Mueller," he said, "do you know how dense this fog is?" "No, my eye's not on the density of the fog, but on the living God who controls every circumstance of my life." Mueller then knelt down and prayed simply. When he had finished, the captain was about to pray, but Mueller put his hand on his shoulder and told him not to. "First, you don't believe he will answer, and second, I believe he has, and there's no need whatever for you to pray about it." The captain looked at Mueller in amazement. "Captain," he continued, I have known my Lord for 52 years, and there's never been a single day that I've failed to get an audience with the king. Get up, Captain, and open the door, and you'll find the fog is gone. Well, that's what it was. He got up, and the fog had lifted. The captain himself, who later told the story of this incident, who was subsequently described by a well-known evangelist as one of the most devoted men I ever knew. I think I can understand why. Well, I could talk, of course, on and on about this, but there's one little thing I think that challenged me a little bit. I like to think I have a little bit of money in the bank in case something happens, you know. I'm sorry I read this, because it's going to make it more difficult. But this has to do with, if I can find this particular one, it has to do with reserve fund, but unfortunately I have... oh, yes, here it is. I forgot to put the page down, but turn to it. A man was talking to him. He says, I suppose you've never contemplated a reserve fund. Mueller answered with much emphasis, that'd be the greatest folly. How could I pray if I had reserves? God would say, bring them out. Bring out those reserves, George Mueller. Oh, no, I've never thought of such a thing. Our reserve fund is in heaven. God, the living God, is our sufficiency. I've trusted in him for one sovereign. I've trusted him for thousands. And I've never trusted in vain. Blessed is the man that trusteth in him. Then, of course, you've never thought of saving for yourself. I shall not soon forget, Parsons wrote, the dignified manner with which I was answered by this mighty man of faith. Hitherto he had been sitting opposite me with his knees almost close to mine, with clasped hands and eyes that betokened a calm, quiet, and meditative spirit. Most of the time he leaned forward, his gaze directed to the floor, but now he sat erect and looked for several moments into my face with an earnestness that seemed to penetrate through my very soul. There was a grandeur and majesty about those undimmed eyes, so accustomed to spiritual visions and to looking into the deep things of God. I do not know whether the question seemed to him a sordid one or whether it touched, shall I say, a lingering remnant of the old self to which he so often alludes in all his discourses. Anyhow, there was no shadow of doubt that it aroused his whole being. After a brief pause during which his face was a sermon and the depths of his clear eyes flashed fire, he unbuttoned his coat, drew from his pocket an old-fashioned purse with rings in the middle, separating the character of the coins. He placed it in my hand, saying, all I am possessed of is in that purse, every penny. Save for myself? Never. When money is sent me for my own use, I pass it on to God. As much as 1,000 pounds has been thus sent at one time. I do not regard these gifts as belonging to me. They belong to him, whose I am and whom I serve. Save for myself? I dare not save. It would be dishonoring to my loving, gracious Father. Parsons handed the purse back to Mueller, who told him the sum it contained. Parsons asked him if he spent much time on his knees. More or less every day, but I live in a spirit of prayer. I pray as I walk about, when I lie down, when I rise up, and the answers are always coming. Thousands and tens of thousands of times have my prayers been answered. When once I am persuaded that the thing is right for the glory of God, I go on praying for it until the answer comes. George Mueller never gives up. That's interesting, isn't it? George Mueller never gives up. I like this. I close with this little incident. In the orphan house, there was a family that was there, and they had a little daughter. And she wanted some things, and she was talking to Mr. Mueller about them, and he told her how to pray for them and so on. And she would get the things that she thought she was going to get. But on one occasion, her mother had tactfully suggested to her daughter that it might be better if she ended her prayers for Jesus' sake instead of like you do George Mueller's. Like you do George Mueller's, as she had been in the habit of doing. So, what a nice way to pray. Lord, answer my prayers like you did George Mueller's. So she learned to ask in Jesus' name. Well, it's quite a testimony to see what God does when we look to Him. And it would be nice if we all had the kind of faith that Mr. Mueller have, which is available as God touches our hearts.